Dublin's Talking Sport with Ken Doherty and Reggie Corrigan.
Sponsored by InsureMyVan.ie. Reduce your price, not your cover.
On Sunshine 106.8.
This is the ball of Tiger Woods.
Vern, this is extremely difficult. This is one of the toughest pitches on the entire place here.
Well, here it comes. Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow. In your life, have you seen anything like that?
Sunshine 106.8.
Hello and a very good morning to you. I'm Reggie Corrigan and welcome to Dublin's Talking Sport on Sunshine 106.8 with thanks to InsureMyVan.ie. As always, we'll have racing on the show. We'll have Dave Weldon from the Racing Hour podcast to discuss the latest news from all the horse racing, and he'll also preview this weekend and give us his lucky 15. In snooker, Ken will be joining us live from Milton Keynes as he speaks about Antrim's Jordan Brown beating Ronnie O'Sullivan in the 2021 Welsh Open final last week. He'll also preview the Gibraltar Open, which takes place this coming Monday at the Marshall Arena. In rugby, we'll be speaking to sports journalist for the Irish Independent and the Left Wing, Will Slattery, about this weekend's fixtures in the 2021 Guinness Six Nations. And how will Andy Farrell's boys in green fare this afternoon as they face the Italians? In football, we'll be speaking to Alan Cawley of Cawley's Call as he gives us a preview of this weekend's fixtures in the Premier League, and he'll also discuss the midweek results in the Champions League and discuss the last 16 draw for the Europa. Delighted to say we'll be joined by former Dublin hurler Paul Ryan, who'll be speaking about his retirement from inter-county hurling, and also after the sad, heartbreaking news during the week of the death of Gary Halpin. I'll be talking to former Leinster coach Matt Williams as he and I pay tribute to Gary. That's what's coming up in the show, but as always, you can get in touch with us by texting us on 087 11 55 777 or WhatsApp us on 087 188 1068. And of course, don't forget, we're on Facebook, Dublin's Talking Sport, Twitter at Sport1068, and Instagram, Dublin's Talking Sport. Well, as always, I'm joined in the studio by Blaine to look at the papers. Morning, Blaine, how are you?
Good morning, Reg, how are you?
Not so bad. Cracking day out there, absolutely beautiful. Just what we like. So, far cry from what I was looking out the window at last week. So it seems like there's an air of, happiness around with when the weather turns like that. So, looking forward to a good weekend of sport.
That's it. Summer's on its way and the days are getting longer.
They are indeed.
More sport than ever as well, which is great too.
Exactly. It seems to be picking up a bit. What have we got in the headlines this morning?
I mean, we start off anyway with the action today in the Premier League. So Manchester City can stretch their lead at the top of the Premier League table to 13 points at lunchtime. So Pep Guardiola's side play host to the season surprise package, West Ham, with kickoff at the Etihad at 12:30. So that'll be a cracking game, Reg.
Yeah.
Two of the league strugglers meet at three, with second from bottom West Brom playing host to Brighton.
Yeah.
And then just a point separates Leeds from Aston Villa ahead of their clash at Ellen Road. And then the late kickoff today is Newcastle seek their first win in three matches when they play host to the resurgent Wolves, who are on good form.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. It's down at the bottom in particular, but that top four clash is certainly gaining some speed, and the battle at the bottom as well. So I think we've resigned ourselves to the fact that Manchester City are going to take the title this year. They're certainly really playing great football at the moment, no doubt about it. But I think that, top four battle and the bottom of the league is what's going to really intrigue people for the remainder of this season. Good news as well for the Ireland team. We've got a replacement for Damien Duff.
Indeed. Anthony Barry has been confirmed as Damien Duff's replacement as Republic of Ireland's assistant. So the 34-year-old is the first team coach at Chelsea, and he'll actually remain in that role despite his new job with the Irish team. So Barry previously worked under ex-Sligo manager Paul Cook at Wigan Athletic. So it's some good news for Ireland and good news for Stephen Kenny, having Anthony in the with him in his staff room. So that's good news. Excellent. For Ireland.
Absolutely. Yeah, we wish him the very best of luck and hopefully it will lead to much success. I see as well Jordan Henderson's had his groin surgery.
Unfortunately. Well, he's had successful groin surgery, but unfortunately it's bad news for the Scousers because he'll be out until at least April. So he's joining Van Dijk, Joe Gomez and Joel Matip on the treatment table. And you have to look at those three names there. He actually was replacement for those three names because they had such bad luck with defenders and with centre-backs being injured. And you look now, Henderson is injured. God help Liverpool.
It's been a tough season, no question about it. It really has, but all the injuries racking up, it's one they'll want to forget, no doubt about it, in their title defence. It wasn't to be, but they've done the best with what they've got there in terms of injuries, so it's a tough one for them. But, you know, we won't write them off yet, but it's a long road without the right players in place. Big weekend of rugby, of course, as well. We saw last night Munster manage to get a victory away from home and a big win for Connacht as well. I was working on that game last night, but they clutched victory from the jaws of defeat, as they say, with a last minute try from Bundy Aki. A great away win for them. Heartbreak for the Italians. Benetton, of course, who have yet to win a game in this year's Pro 14 competition. An abysmal season for them. Their coach, Kieran Crowley, leaving at the end of this year, a year early in his contract after such a horrific season for him. But they looked like they were all set for that big win last night with just 90 seconds left on the clock. They couldn't hold out. And Bundy Aki, who had a quiet game by his standards, but he managed to find a way to get on the end of a try and win the game for Connacht. So a huge victory for them. Of course, Connacht need to win all five. Well, that was one of them, and four more now of their remaining fixtures to have any hope of finishing top of Conference B. That is, of course, if they can beat Munster this week and try and let Munster to slip away, because Munster are 9 points clear of them. Doesn't look like Munster are slipping up anytime soon. Joey Carberry making a welcome return last night for Ireland fans. That would be great for him to see, and Munster fans, of course, because he's been plagued with injury, and everybody's, you know, pinning their hopes on Joey being the next out half. So we wish him well, and good to see him getting back last night, and good to see Munster getting that away victory as well. Of course, there is loads to come rugby-wise in the show later on as well. We've got Will Slattery coming on to talk about Ireland's chances against Italy later on this afternoon in Rome, as Andy Farrell has made a number of changes to the side to try and get Ireland back on track after two defeats so far in this Six Nations Championship. And I also want to talk to him as well about the English Welsh game, that huge one that's going on the Principality Stadium a little bit later on today as well, as Wales, who many people had written off before this championship even began, are now 2-2 with England at home, and I'm sure they'll fancy their chances to get in that one. So plenty to come in rugby circles as well a little later on the show. What else have we got in the papers?
We've got some news in the GAA. So 37 motions are up for debate as the 2021 GAA Congress gets underway today. So the event will be held purely online due to COVID-19 restrictions. And among the motions that will be discussed are the possibility introduction of a black card for the cynical play in hurling, mm-hmm, and the proposed split season. And then meanwhile, Larry McCarthy will be sworn in as the 14th president of the GAA, replacing John Horan.
Very good. Okay, there was plenty underway as well in the golf. I was watching a bit of this during the week. The WGC Workday Championship. It looks like a different world as you're watching the golf on the television these days, and the beautiful greens and sunshine and weather and the longing to get back out on a golf course and play as badly as I do, but at least walk around it and have a bit of crack. But Rory McIlroy's dropped back to 5-under par. Shane Lowry is 2-under. And America's Brooks Koepka, he's leading the way at 11-under par. Seamus Power is 6 shots off the lead heading into day 3 of the Puerto Rico Open. The Waterford golfer is 5-under after a second round of 70. And Padraig Harrington reached halfway in 2-under. The American Brandon Wu is the main man to catch at 11-under par. In cycling?
Yeah, so Sam Bennett will look to complete a hat-trick of stage wins at the UAE Tour today. So having won 2 out of the last 3 stages, the Waterford sprinter will be gunning for victory on the final stage of the Yas Island. So it's very good news. Sam Bennett having, you know, continuing his fantastic run success, obviously after last year's Tour de France. Some good news, Reg.
Yeah, well, it's badly needed at this stage. Okay, that's it for the papers for this morning. I am going to be talking to Dave Weldon of the Racing Hour podcast to get this week's racing tips. Good morning, Dave. How are you?
Not too bad, Reg. How's things?
Not so bad at all now, I have to say. Beautiful day out there. Cracking weather for racing, no question about it. Where are we going this week?
So we've got two from Fairy House, one from Kempton and one from Newcastle. Good racing all around today. A couple of races rescheduled from during the week that were called off in Ireland have made the cut at Fairy House today, so that's all good news. And we'll start with the Red Mills Hurdle, grade two. It was rescheduled from Gorin, 145. Jason the Militant is the 13th eighth favourite for Henry de Bromhead and Rachel Blackmore. I think he'll take all the beating in this race. He was third in the Morgiana at Punchestown in November behind Abacadabras and San Roa, and that form should be strong enough to see him beat this field. So he's the first in the Lux 15 at 13th to 8.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Jason the Militant. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so then the 4 o'clock at Fairy House, Visionarian for Pierre Faggy and Kevin Sexton. He just looks at a handicap snip off 1-2-4. He was second the last day behind the Devil's Coachman of Noel Meads, who has won again since. The third in that race is a good horse, a good mare, who looks set to go to Cheltenham Festival for one of the handicaps. So 9-4, Visionarian for Pierre Fahey in the 4 o'clock at Fairy House is the next one, the Lux 15.
Visionarian, okay, excellent stuff. Go ahead, yep.
Yeah, then in the 115 at Kempton, Gunsight Ridge for Ollie Murphy and Aidan Coleman, a 9-4 chance. His second last time, when he was running for the first time in a handicap, the form of that has worked out well, with the winner going on to win a graded race last weekend. So that form looks strong, and he's only raised £2 retrospectively for that, so he's on a mark of 1-2-2. And in a competitive race, he looks sure to go well at 9-4. So that's Gunsight Ridge in the 115 at Kempton.
Excellent stuff. Okay.
And then the final one is the 315 Newcastle, Salty Boy for David Bridgewater and Brendan Pell. He's a 4-1 chance for the Eider. The marathon trip, 4 miles, will take some getting, but this horse looks set to play a big role. He was third at Haydock in December, and that form reads really well. Sam's Adventure won that race, and he's a bigger price here today. But with the difference in the weight, I think Salty Boy can get one over on him, and he's still an improving horse. So at 4-1, Salty Boy would hopefully make it a full house and look 15.
Excellent stuff. Okay, that's brilliant. Okay, we can have a look at those afterwards. What else is going on this week in the world of racing?
Well, with the British announcement, the British government announcement last week that of the roadmap for the exit of COVID and restrictions and stuff like that, it came to light that amateurs wouldn't be able to ride at the Cheltenham Festival this year. So that rules them out of the National Hunt Chase, Kim Muir and the Hunter Chase. So the likes of Patrick Mullins and Jamie Codd and Derek O'Connor from Ireland won't be able to ride unless they go pro. Jamie Codd and Derek O'Connor are more likely to focus on the point-to-point scene in Ireland, so they won't be able to ride, which is a big shame for them, because and for punters really, because they're so experienced around there and they're like professionals in all but name. So that's a big shame, but it looks like Patrick Mullins might go professional. He doesn't ride so much in the local point-to-point scene, so have less effect on him, and he has such a good book of rides for Cheltenham with rides in grade ones against professionals. So he's just trying to figure out how he goes about going back to being an amateur then after Cheltenham, and how long it'll take and what he'll miss out on. But it looks like he might go professional.
Oh, very good. And I know I said this to you before, but Cheltenham, how's it all shaping up?
Well, the handicap entries were released during the week and the numbers are significantly down. Now, it still has to bear light on whether that's social runners who are now deciding to go to Aintree, where it looks like crowds and owners definitely will be back on the race course in the UK, and whether the social runner is down. But the Irish entry looks slightly down as well. Whether that's a result of Brexit or COVID, we don't know yet. And we're kind of still waiting on guidance from the government on to how things are going to play out in terms of PCR tests. And I know the exemption, I think, is back for if you're riding a grade one, you don't have to self-isolate for 2 weeks when you come back. But it's still very much in the air, up in the air. And then I suppose the French rugby a couple of weeks ago kind of doesn't really play well in terms of the outbreak there. I know it didn't transfer over to the Irish, but it's still a risk and it's still out there, you know. We're still in level 5 lockdown.
Yeah. No, there's still certainly the rugby episode caused a lot of controversy around as well, and a lot of people are talking about the game postponed now as well. So, yes, by no means is this thing over, and there still has to be huge caution at all costs on this. So I can see what you're saying. It's still up in the air. somewhat on it. There was sad news, of course, during the week as well, as the great Tom Foley passed away, renowned trainer, of course, of racehorse Denali at 74 years of age, based in Bagnallstown. So that's sad news.
Yeah, very sad news. A great trainer, a great character as well. So, and a gentleman by all accounts as well. So very sad news for the racing world indeed.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, Dave, as always, it's been a pleasure talking to you this week, and we'll get your lucky 15 out there. And you have a good week and the best of luck with everything. Hope you get a good few winners.
Thanks, Reg. I need them after the last few weeks anyway.
Yeah, well, we still have faith in you. Don't worry.
Thanks.
Okay, that's Dave Weldon there of the Racing Hour podcast giving us his thoughts for this week and, you know, looking at the Lucky 15 and giving us a bit of an insight into the Cheltenham as well. Yeah, by no means is it a foregone conclusion that these, you know, events are going to go ahead. We still have quite a lot of uncertainty with this COVID and everything that's gone on around it. And as he rightly says, the rugby is a real indicator of just how, you know, turbulent the whole world is in terms of events and everything going on at the moment as well. He gave us the Lucky 15 there. So going to Fairy House, first of all. So it's the 145 is Jason the Militant. And at the 4 o'clock there, he's going for Visionarian. In Kempton, it's the 115 Gunsight Ridge. And in Newcastle, we're looking at the 315 Salty Boy. So that's Jason the Militant, Visionarian, Gunsight Ridge and Salty Boy. They are your Lucky 15 for today. Now, it's time to turn my attention to some very sad news that I got during the week. Like so many people on Thursday morning, I woke up to the shocking news that my teammate Gary Halpin had died at the age of 55. With everything that's happened this year, the news, it really hit me like a ton of bricks, and I don't know how long I spent staring at the phone before I rang Shane Byrne for confirmation. Gary was one of the larger-than-life characters who left an impression on everybody he met, and I was no different to that. I'm joined now on the phone by one of Gary's former coaches and friends, Matt Williams, to talk about the great man. Good morning, Matt. How are you?
Good morning, Rich. It was lovely to talk to you, but today's a sad day to be talking, mate, isn't it?
It is.
I can't believe.
There's no
can't
question.
Believe what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, there's no question, Matt. Like everybody, you know, it was just such a shock. So young, 55 years of age, and, you know, it really hits you when it's kind of one of your own peers and someone that you played with all along. And I've heard some glowing tributes to Gary all during the week, and I suppose that's a sign of the man himself, the esteem that he was held in, but the high regard that he was, you know, held with it as well. I mean, I was talking to Trevor Brennan, he rang me from France during the week, and Liam Toland, a lot of people that I wouldn't have spoken to, Victor in New York, of course, that I mightn't have spoken to for a while, and they were all kind of feeling the same way and just feeling a little bit lost by the news.
Well, Reg, you text me, and like you, I actually said out loud, no.
Yeah.
I just couldn't conceive it, you know. And I think the first thing that just get, you know, Gary was a great athlete. He threw the hammer for Ireland and he played rugby for Ireland, two World Cups. Came to Leinster when the club was just turning into professionalism. But and we're not understating his great athleticism, but he's such an incredible person. And that's what we're missing. It's not the rugby player, even though that was outstanding. And that's what we're seeing on our TVs. But for the people that were his teammates and workmates, it's the person. You know, and it wasn't just that motion that he's remembered for when he scores this great try against New Zealand. He gives New Zealand the finger.
Yeah.
But Gary was just a comedian. He should have been on stage. He was a comedian. He made you feel better. Every day he was like a bottle of champagne.
Yeah.
He popped and fizzed and bubbled every day. And in the environments that we're in, which are very tense and very and hardworking and stressful and competitive, he was just a tonic for everyone, me included. You know, I was waiting for your call. I was thinking of the things he used to do to me when I was his coach. And he would come into my office, and every single time he came into my office, he talked in an Australian accent doing an impression of me. not just for the first 10 seconds. He would hold it for 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah.
He would just be, and he was taking the mickey out of you the whole time. Like he was just exceptional. Some of the stories we can't tell, they're probably not right to tell on national radio, but he one day at training, just threw a bizarre humour on him. We were preparing for a big game, playing Northampton with the current European champions, and we actually beat them home and away.
Yeah.
And Gary was starting, but I'll never forget this, and he's kneeling down at training like he's injured. He puts his hand up and calls me over, and I walk over to him, and he wants actually for me to squat down. So I squat down next to him, he's holding a stick, and he looks at me and just says, straight in the eye, says, "Apache arrows this far north, we better double the guard." Handed me the stick and ran off. And it took about five steps and just burst out laughing, you know.
Yeah.
Just a mess. And it broke all the tension at training. Just all of a sudden the tension was gone and everyone was laughing. And then he would switch straight back in there. Flying mode, but he was an exceptional man.
He really was. I mean, I remember, funnily enough, I was, I hadn't even gone into the ranks of professional rugby. I went on tour with Greystones in 1995 to South Africa for that World Cup. It was a fantastic tour. And I was at that game where he scored that infamous try against the All Blacks. And I'll never forget, you know, it was a great try. I mean, that was, I think the emotion just got to me. Afterwards, he kind of said, well, you know, I kind of regret doing what I did when I scored. But he said, it's just, you know, the haka had got me going and they had disrespected the Irish team during the week. Sean Fitzpatrick was calling us paddies and there was all this kind of stuff going on. And he said, it was an overflow of emotion. But the try itself was amazing. Now, you know, it was probably the worst thing he ever did, reacting the way he did, because I think that just got the backs up of the All Blacks and they went on to spank us in the remainder of that game. But, you know, he was a great athlete. That is the big part of it as well. As you said, a fantastic hammer thrower as well, and spent a lot of time in the States doing that.
Yeah, he did. University of Manhattan, and, you know, represented Ireland in a world championship. To represent Ireland in two sports, you know, that's people like Victor Costello, our great mate. I spoke to Victor as well in New York after I heard about Gary.
Yeah.
You know, he's an Olympian as well in shot put. I mean, Neil Francis threw the javelin. You know, those days are over. The sports, you're never going to produce two of them.
Yeah.
But Gary, you know, was such an amazing person, because, like, Justin Fitzpatrick, who also played for Ireland, who you and I both know well, Reg, played for Ulster, but Gary and who were at London Irish together for 5 years. Gary was the first captain of London Irish in the professional era. And, you know, Justin put out a message on social media this week. It was just so heartfelt and so so pure in its emotions that he'd lost not only his captain and a friend, but his mentor, a guy that guided him through all aspects of his playing life. And the other part, you know, is Justin Fitzpatrick, when I was always laugh, when Leinster played Ulster at Ravenhill, and this is Gary could be so inappropriate, he was actually marking at scrum time his old friend, Justin.
Yeah.
And as they came into the scrum, they were about to pack in, and Gary stood up and said to the referee, "He's making sectarian comments to me, sir."
Yeah.
And he said, "By the way, this is the referee." He said, "What's a Athenian?" And the referee is looking at him. And Fitzy is doubled over laughing. And, of course, in the stands, everyone thought Gary and Fitzy was about to have a fight, because Fitzy's pointing his finger at Gary. And what Fitzy was actually saying was, "Gary, stop making me laugh."
Yeah.
Stop making me laugh. And that's just, that was just Gary. There was his opportunity to make someone laugh, the referee, Fitzy, to play to the audience of the stand, and he just took advantage of it every time. And Fitzy, you know, there was nothing offensive about what he said. It was just fun.
No, absolutely.
And Fitzy remembers his day as this great person.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's the way most people do. But I think as well, I remember that time in particular in Leinster, and we were all very young professionals. Professionalism itself was very young in Ireland. Gary had been on the trail for a while. You know, he'd been in the UK, he'd been with London Irish and Harlequins, he'd sort of done the campaign. He was that bit older than the rest of us. I felt that, you know, people have been talking about his sense of humour and how fabulous he was and all that, but I remember particularly how he was able to come in and he had this way of making the younger players feel a part of the squad and bring everybody in together. So at a time when maybe guys were pushing for positions and there was a bit of competition within the squad and everybody was looking to try and get into that first team lineup, and there was a little bit of anxiety around and a little bit of pressure, he had this way of making the younger players feel more relaxed and inclusive and bring them in.
Yeah, mate, he was a tractor just about to come past me. Your edge, I'm out in the bush, that doesn't make too much noise.
That's all right, don't worry.
He was a leader. He was a leader, mate. And in his professional life, Gary was a wonderful educator as well, and spent all his years after his professional rugby life as a teacher and a housemaster. He's down at Ross Cray there and Gary led people. He wasn't, and there's a big difference, as you know, Reg. Captaincy is one thing, but everyone's a leader. And he was a leader and mentor for so many people. Mm. So many of those young guys coming through. And even the older guys. Like, Gary would not be adverse to speaking his mind to the older guys, saying, listen, mate, that's not right, or what do you think of this, or we need to do this. And that's why Gary was coming to my office so often. He would provide me with feedback. And Reg, you know, like you know yourself, you've got to value your senior players, and you've got to listen to those people. And when you got a leader like Gary, or we had a leader like Gary in our team, that just makes the whole process move forward. It's not everyone just thinks it's the coach and the captain, and it's not. The whole organisation has to be full of leaders, and that's what he did. And he did mentor a lot of those young guys. There's a wonderful photo that came out this week with a very young Leo Cullen and Peter Smith standing around Gary, you know, and I was just thinking those two boys were 21 at that stage. And what a great influence he was on them. You know, I'm sure Leo remembers how humour just cut the tension, how humour brought people together. And Gary was quite often showing his leadership and by bringing that humour into the group.
I always found it a little bit ironic that he ended up being a teacher and in a school situation, because, you know, when I think back to him in our environment in Leinster, one of the greatest messages he'd ever get, and you know, the thoughts of him being the disciplinarian or being the one who was laying down the law or trying to put young guys on the straight and narrow or on the right path. It just, the two, I can't marry those two, but by all accounts, a fantastic teacher and really loved in Ross Cray and doing an amazing job down there.
Yeah, he was much loved in all the schools he was at. Mm. Yeah, I agree with you. So I think it's the patriot-turned-gamekeeper.
Yeah,
I remember once he tried to steal his jersey, as was the great tradition back in the amateur days, and we decided to set him up because we knew he'd stolen it, and we set the whole thing up so that we'd have a big meeting that we had a thief in the group.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone in the whole room knew that it was Gary, except Gary didn't know that we all knew.
Yeah, I remember him well.
And we dragged him through until finally he figured out we were finally getting our revenge on him. But if you want your kids educated by someone that's been there and done it and has that sense of humour and that sense of what's right and wrong and the sense of fun, the sense of joy of life. And Gary had a great joy of life in him, Rich.
He certainly did, absolutely, no question. But I remember in particular, you know, at our time at Leinster, Gary used to arrive on this motorbike. I'm sure you remember it well. And he was the worst.
Yeah,
he was
yeah.
dangerous. He was lethal on this bike. I mean, how anybody gave him a license to ride this motorbike was beyond me. But, like, you know, I'd remember we'd be standing around maybe in the car park of Old Belvedere there as we were waiting to go out training, whatever. And literally, Gazza would be coming along on this bike and running over people's feet and legs. And for you as a coach, it must have been a nightmare. He was doing more damage. Like, on purpose, he was riding this motorbike. Like a big heavy machine over people, over your players, and I was captain. I was kind of going, "What are you doing? Like you're taking out lads for the weekend and everything else." He's like, you know, he didn't even see. It was just again another way of messing around for him, you know.
He used to stop outside. So I used to be at him the whole time and say, "Listen, mate, you got to get a car. Like you can't be driving around a motorbike. You know, you're going to get hurt." And he would often drive into the car park, come near my window and just rev his bike up into the red level.
Yeah.
Right outside my window.
Absolutely.
With a cheeky smile on his face, mate, all the time.
Well, I remember one particular incident with the motorbike where, you know, we used to go down. Obviously, training were long days in those days, and we didn't have the facilities that they do now. We didn't have the on-site facilities. We were just at the very beginning of it all. But we used to go down to Kiley's, the great Dublin pub, at lunchtime, and we'd go down to Pat, and we'd get our lunch down there, you know. But I remember we were down there all of it.
Yeah.
Having lunch one of the days, anyway, in between training sessions, and Gary had come up on the bike or whatever, and he headed off, and we were coming back down, and I was in the car, and we were driving back down to Belvedere, and there was a bit of a traffic jam. We couldn't really figure out what was going on and what was the delay here, because, you know, at that time of the day, there shouldn't be any traffic or whatever, and we eventually get to the bridge there just as we were about to turn left, getting back down to Old Belvedere, and there's an ambulance in the middle of the road, and we're going, oh, there's been an accident, something's happened, you know. Lo and behold, we come across the accident, and there's the bike across the middle of the road, and our Gary on a stretcher up against the wall. And I'm going, oh my God, what's happened here? You know, Gary he's been taken out. You know, finally, someone's got him on the bike. But what had happened was he had a little tip with a car. I don't know how it happened or whatever. It was nothing too dramatic anyway. But the poor ambulance guys, he was so big, they had put him on. He was lying on the ground, roaring and screaming and shouting at him as only Gary could, by all accounts. And the poor ambulance guys had got him onto this stretcher, and they were trying to put him up into the back of the ambulance, but he was too heavy for them, and they weren't able to lift it. So they'd kind of had him propped up against the wall at the side of the bridge there, and he was facing out to all traffic, and he was leaned up on this stretcher looking out. And I stopped the car, and I got out, and I was going, Gary, okay, what's going on? He says, keep going, Reg, keep going. I'm fine. I'm just sorting out the old retirement plan. So he had put himself through this thing. He got a little tip on the bike, and he was making the most of it. There was no question of it whatsoever. That was Gary. He was a character for all. But it was heartbreaking news during the week to hear of Gary's passing. And, you know, there's been tributes all week long. You can hear there Matt Williams, who we've just lost, but on that phone line. But you could hear from Matt, as his coach, the impression that Gary Halpin had on so many people. And it was heartbreaking during the week, and such a sad week for all of us involved in rugby. And, of course, for Carol and his three children, for Gary to go so young. 1966 to 2021. It was too short, 55 years of age. But we loved you, Gary, and we know that he would have been looking down, and we want everybody to carry on and remember him for what he was, being such a wonderful man and such a great influence on everybody that he made, and that impression that he made on everybody that he knew. That's Gary Halpin. May you rest in peace. But it's time to turn our attention now to our own Ken Doherty, who is beavering away over in the UK. Good morning, Ken. How are you?
Morning, Reg. How are you?
I'm doing okay, thanks. It's not a bad day here. I presume it's okay over there too?
Yeah, beautiful sunny day. Perfect for snooker.
Absolutely perfect. Yes, indeed. And it's been perfect snooker. I have to look back to last week. What a performance from Jordan Brown. What a win.
Well, incredible, isn't it? An incredible story. I mean, you know, a couple of years ago, he's fallen on and off the tour, but a couple of years ago, he's working in a petrol station. He used to get up at 5:30 in the morning for his shift and then play snooker in the afternoon. And to win his first ranking tournament, to beat Ronnie O'Sullivan 9-8 in the final in Wales was quite incredible. Wonderful story. Delighted for him. He's a practice partner of Mark Allen up in Antrim.
Yeah.
And a very likeable lad. And it's a fantastic win for him. His first final. And, of course, to beat Ronnie O'Sullivan, as I said, 9-8 was an extra sort of little feather in his cap. And a wonderful victory for him.
Did you get to talk to him much afterwards?
I mean, he was totally sort of in shock about it.
Yeah.
He had to come to play in Milton Keynes a couple of days later. Lost John Higgins 6-0, so you could tell the after effects after. He got a lot of attention,
yeah,
you know, after his big win. But he was delighted. I mean, the money would mean so much. He could probably buy a petrol station now.
Yeah.
He won't have to work. But, yeah, the money would...
He won for that.
He got 70,000.
Oh, very nice.
So he's moved from number 80 in the world up into the top 40, and he got into the Players' Championship, which was fantastic, an extra few bob for him. So, no, he's done really, really well, and the money will go a long way with him, you know.
And I suppose people will probably look at it then and try and work things out. And they're probably saying, well, maybe this new format of without the crowds, that's helping players like him to relax, maybe?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's certainly, I mean, with a packed auditorium there and you're playing Ronnie O'Sullivan in the final, it's even more daunting, you know? It's like you're playing an away match. But I suppose with no crowds there, there's sort of, you don't have the same sort of atmosphere. So there's less pressure on, for sure. And but still in all, he played wonderful snooker. You know, he really did outplay Ronnie O'Sullivan at times. Ronnie wasn't at his best, but at the same time, you know, Jordan really put it up to him and made a really wonderful break in the last frame to clinch it. I was really so happy for him. He's a really good lad. Like, and it's a great victory for him, you know.
Fantastic. Well, everybody loves the underdog story, so there's no question.
Yeah. 750-1 he was. 750. And he was Ronnie O'Sullivan was 1-14 in the final, would you believe?
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. What's going on this week? So we're looking at the Players' Championship, isn't it?
Yeah, we're in the Players' Championship. Ronnie O'Sullivan came through a really tough semi-final last night against Barry Hawkins, 6-4. He was 3-0 down at one stage, but started motored after that. And the other semi-final tonight now is John Higgins against Corin Wilson. John Higgins beat Mark Selby in yesterday's quarter-final, 6-0.
Wow.
And Mark Selby, the lowest score in a best of 11, only 6 points he scored in the six frames, would you believe?
Wow. That's incredible.
And that 6 points came in one frame. The rest of them were all zeros.
That's unbelievable.
It was the most one-sided best of 11 I think I've ever seen, particularly when you've got two top players playing against each other. Okay, you might have a top player against a lower ranked player.
Yeah.
But I think the record was 11 points before that. But, I mean, against Mark Selby, who normally dominates, opponents in the way John Higgins dominates. I mean, he didn't get a shot. He five frames, he didn't put one ball. So
was he in the seat for the whole thing?
Yeah, honestly, it was quite one-sided. I've never seen anything like it against two top players. But John Higgins was so dominant. Safety, success, pot success, rest success, they were all like up in the... I think his pot success was 99%. I've never seen that. Wow. For a best of 11 match. Yeah, so he's in great form. He's made a few technical sort of changes and seems to be working for him. He's in great form and he's playing Corin Wilson for a place in the final to play Ronnie O'Sullivan. I mean, the two of them have turned pro in 1992 and 29 years later, they could be playing in another final. Can you believe that? Quite incredible.
Absolutely incredible. It's right now. You know, I know Jordan Brown got the better of Ronnie last week, but his form seems to be very good at the moment, though. I mean, he's getting to finals. He's getting, you know, he's right up there the whole time. And okay, he didn't get across the line last week, but, you know, he seems to be in great form.
Yeah, he's back in the final again for Sunday, which would be...
following up back-to-back finals.
Yeah, it's not easy. It's not easy because sometimes, as I said, Jordan Brown has had a little bit of a hangover over it. Ronnie O'Sullivan could have had the same, but he looks very determined, very focused. Of course, he is the current world champion. It's coming into, you know, world championship almost time now. That'll be in the middle of April. So he's gearing up for that, obviously. He wants to get his hands on seven to equal Stephen Hendry's for sure. But he's playing some great stuff. I mean, this is his fourth final now this season. But he hasn't managed to get his hands on one yet. So he'll be very determined on Sunday. He's playing some really good stuff and very, very determined. And just like John Higgins as well. John Higgins will be interested in matching out tonight against Corin Wilson. He's one of the young guys coming through and knocking on the door. And it'll be interesting to see how that match goes tonight. But I think a Higgins O'Sullivan final will be very, very special for sure, you know.
Excellent stuff. And do you think Ronnie would be able to kind of get it done this time just to try?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, whoever he plays in the final is going to be a tough match. But it's hard. When Ronnie plays well, it's hard to see anybody beat him. You know, it doesn't matter who it is. And I think all the rest of the players know that. So, from one day to the next, as we know in sport, Reggie, in every sport, you know, it's a completely different day. So, I mean, Ronnie played superb in his quarterfinal, but then last night struggled in a semi-final. So if he struggles against either Wilson or Higgins, he could come unstuck. So, but that's the interesting story behind it all.
Very good. Okay. Listen, you got a little bit of an appointment yourself. We didn't talk about it on the World Players Representative.
Oh, yeah. I've been elected chairman of the World world. We set up a new sort of WPBSA, a World Snooker Players Board. And I'm on the board, and they elected me chairman. So I'm chairman of the players. Yeah, so as I represent the players, I'm the chairman of the representative board. Yeah, so it's a nice appointment, and
it's a real sign you're getting old, though, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. That's why I kept it quiet.
I wasn't letting that one pass.
No,
way.
No. You were.
Now you're on the board.
I know. Things have changed, eh? But I know it's a great.
Well,
it's a nice post to. And it's a nice to have a board of players to represent, you know, what the players are feeling and trying to make little changes. I mean, the snooker tour as it is now is fantastic. And, you know, we're one of the few sports that have been able to keep actually more tournaments going during the snooker calendar during this pandemic time. So, snooker's in a good state at the moment, even during these bad times. But it's nice to have a representative board, you know, for players, whatever they're thinking or whatever changes we can make to the tour.
And there's no doubt about it, as you rightly say, snooker, it's never been more popular, you know, because you're able to get that televised coverage of it the whole time and in a safe environment. So, I mean...
Yeah, absolutely,
Okay, let's turn our attention to football, as we always do when we're having these chats. So, Chelsea at the weekend, is it Chelsea's for you guys?
Yeah, big game, isn't it?
But I think you've got a very good chance of getting a result in.
Yeah, I think so. I think they're starting to play well, aren't they? I mean, they played really good during the week. I mean, that was sort of just a run out, you know, in the Europa League, particularly after the first leg of winning 4-0. So the tie was already done and dusted. But Chelsea and, of course, AC Milan is one to look forward to in the Europa League. That's a wonderful draw, particularly with Zlatan coming back to Old Trafford. Very, very exciting. But yeah, Chelsea this week, it was a tough game. I think they've tightened up at the back, haven't they, since that Tuchel has taken over.
Yeah,
that'll be a really good test for Manchester United at the moment. But they're in good form. I just hope that they can keep playing to that, because like, they've been stop-starting. They've lost a lot of points over the last couple of months, points that they should have really won, like the West Brom game, the Sheffield United game, even the Arsenal game. You know, I know you won't like be saying that, but...
I've given up on it now at this stage. not too worried anymore.
Well, they had a good win during the week, so they're in the Europa. They're in the last
win,
So against Chelsea, yeah, it'll be a tough game. Chelsea, a lot of good players. They've got a good manager, and I think they're a lot more of a solid outfit under Tuchel. They were conceding a lot of goals with Lampard, but yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a cracking game.
It's amazing how the talk has died down with Ole and all the rifts and everything else in the players and the dressing room. He's lost the dressing room. It's amazing how it's all died down again with a few results, isn't it?
I think he's done a great job, to be honest. You know, I really do. I know the jury is still out on him because of his. He may not have that ruthlessness like maybe Alex Ferguson had, but I think he's brought. You can see how well he's brought that team together. You know.
Yeah.
I think that Bruno Fernandes was a great signing, and the way he's introduced some of the younger players as well. I think that was during the week in that Europa League. I think that was the 4,000th match in a row where they had a youth academy player in the squad. It's incredible. Okay. So you can see how the introduction of young players and the policy of young players in the squad is very, very important. And I think he's kept that. But also, as you said, he's really sort of got that squad together, and they seem like a really good team now. They still need a couple of players, there's no doubt about the challenge Man City. But at the moment, I think they're going in the right direction, you know, and I like Ollie.
No, I think Fernandes has been an unbelievable signing.
Yeah.
They've dragged them. You know, the scores he's getting, the way he's playing, you know, that aggressive nature that he plays with.
Yeah.
It seems to have lifted everything around him.
Absolutely, yeah. I think he's their talisman now. I mean, he's shouting at them. You know, he's grabbed them together, and he's been the glue that the Manchester United needed, because they were going through a terrible patch before he arrived. So I think, as you said, he sort of dragged them all together, and he's been an inspiration, to be honest. And he's great to watch. He's scoring so many goals since he arrived. It's incredible. And but they need another couple of him. Like, you know, they definitely need another centre back. And they could do with a really top centre forward, you know. And and then they might be challenging. But yeah, he's been an outstanding player. He could get player of the year, actually, Fernandez, you know.
Excellent. Okay. What's coming up for you, tournament wise?
So we finish here on Sunday, and then the Gibraltar Open starts in sunny Milton Keynes on Monday. Stephen Hendry's, actually, Stephen Hendry's comeback next Tuesday night. He plays his good friend Matt Seltz. It's been the long-awaited comeback all season. We've been waiting for him to dust his cue down and get it out, and he's finally doing it in the Gibraltar Open. And of course, he'll be playing in the qualifiers for the World Championship as well. There's apparently a lovely piece in the Times today, not the Irish Times, the English Times today about him. If you have it with you, check it out. Yeah.
I definitely will give that a check out, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
You mind yourself over there. Good luck on Monday. Yeah. I hope you get a victory, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Okay, thanks, Reg. Have a great weekend.
You too. Take care. That's Ken Doherty there. Our own Ken Doherty, of course, coming to us live from the UK, giving us all the latest detail. Just a text message in there looking for the Lucky 15 again. I'll give it to you really quickly. It's Jason the Militant. This is in Ferry House. Then the Visionarian at 4 o'clock. Kempton is Gunsight Ridge. And then in Newcastle, it's Salty Boy. So we'll put that up all our social media channels as well for you to look at as the show progresses. It's time to talk to Will Slattery now about a big weekend in Irish rugby. Good morning, Will. How are you?
Good, thanks, Reggie. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Very well. Looking forward to the games today. I saw an interesting tweet during the week welcoming Dave Kilcoyne, Ian Henderson, CJ Stander and Tadhg Byrne to Leinster. I thought it was a funny way to put it, but I kind of get where people are coming from. There's mass changes going on in the Irish setup with Andy Farrell, I suppose. They kind of had to be, really. Pressure's been on and people are expecting to see, you know, a complete change of form and the way that we play the game.
Yeah, like, to be fair, the team selection, I think, can give people a bit of enthusiasm and a bit of excitement heading into today, you know, even taking into account that playing Italy, you're more likely to get some attacking opportunities. Like, you have a really dynamic front row, Dave Kilcoyne back, Ronan Keller, we know what they can do with the ball in hand. Tadhg Furlong, I think, has kind of, obviously everyone was talking about how much of a miss he was, given his pedigree as a Lion and, you know, a Grand Slam winner, Champions Cup winner, etc. But even in the little bits he's played so far, it just kind of brought back into focus how vital he is for this team. He's so skillful for a big man, for a tight head prop. He's probably one of the best handlers of the ball in the tight five, if not the best handler of the ball. And even though Porter has been playing unbelievable, I'm not surprised they want to potentially move him back to loose head, because the prospect of having Porter and Furlong as like the long-term props, you know, with their skill set, with their power they're carrying, is very exciting. And then having Tadhg Byrne in the back row as well with Will Connors, I think, give it a bit of dynamism too. I think Connors in particular could be that kind of link player that people are kind of crying out for. He loves to offload the tackle, he loves to pass before contact. You know, that's been one of the features of his play, I think, over the last maybe 6-7 months since rugby return. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw him get on a lot of ball today and you know, really kind of be that kind of exciting carrier and maybe passing out a tackle that I know a lot of people are crying out for.
Interesting one at 10. Again, it's the topic of conversation constantly, and we see with the return of Carberry last night, a lot of people will be pinning their hopes on Joey Carberry making a big comeback and getting lots of game time at Munster and building his way back to a level where he can slot into that 10 jersey. But, you know, with the talk during the week and the hints from Johnny Sexton that he may not be there for too much longer, and the fact that there was an issue over HIAs and all that kind of stuff, was there ever a chance that he wasn't going to pick Sexton for this game and maybe start to try out these 10s now that, especially against Italy?
Yeah, well, it's a funny one you mentioned, you know, Sexton, because he did say, you know, something, he's like, World Cup cycles, you know, Dash, you know, I might be a part of all this one. And then people were like, oh, is that him potentially retiring? And then in the print briefing right after, he was like, what do you want me to say? Like, I'm not going to be like, oh, I'm definitely going to be there. I'm not going to pick myself. Like, so in classic Johnny fashion, like, he very quickly kind of put to bed any talk that was him kind of 1 foot out the door. And in terms of this game, Andy Farrell pretty much immediately set his stall out after losing to France and said, I'm picking the strongest team I have. Like, you know, he was asked, is this a chance for a Harry Byrne, you know, someone like that? And immediately he was like, no, the strongest team I can put out, I'm going to put out. And that I think that was pretty much that with the halfbacks or out half as much as anything else. Like, it's an interesting one. Like, obviously, Joey Carberry coming back last night, you know, he didn't get to do much other than maybe get smashed by Ray Lilo after his first touch, and people were slightly worried, but thankfully he dusted himself up and kicked a great conversion at the end. He's the great hope. For me, I've gotten to the stage where, like, I don't have a huge issue with Sexton starting this game, in the sense that I just don't think Billy Burns or Ross Byrne are the answer. So, while you could say, oh, let's just give them a game against Italy, it doesn't really bother me that much, because I really don't think they're going to be the long-term solution. Is there a point in committing that much game time to guys that I don't think personally are going to be a big part of the World Cup plan? I don't know if there is, especially when I think it's about getting to the end of the Six Nations, getting some wins, getting some momentum, using the summer tour then to launch the next phase of the World Cup plan. Because if you look back to the last cycle, it was that 2017 summer tour. Carberry came in, Stockdale came in, Dan Levy came in, James Ryan came in, Josh Van der Fleer. These guys got a huge bed of experience there and really launched the second phase. Now, I know it wasn't ultimately successful, but in terms of bringing through young players, the halfway point of the cycle makes sense to kick on from there. So I don't have a huge issue with Sexton starting the next three games. But then from the summer on, hopefully Carberry gets a run of fitness. They can really push on then and find the identity of his long-term successor.
See, there's an article in your own paper today, just, you know, the great upsets. I was involved in one of them in 99 in Lens, the defeat to Argentina, but they're looking back at the Japanese defeat and the 2015 defeat to Argentina and all these big upsets. And, of course, Italy is in there as well, the 22-15 defeat in the 2013 Six Nations. It always, you know, makes me wonder with these games as to what is a good result. You know, what is, for a coach like Andy Farrell, who's under pressure, what are people going to be happy with? If you go out and put 50 points on Italy, oh, well, it's only Italy. If you go out and you lose, or you only win by 5 or 6 points, then, oh my God, we're in disaster. Like, what is a good result against Italy for them today?
Yeah, like, I think you're dead right there. But I still think option A, putting 50 points and saying, it's only Italy, is a lot more preferable to option B, going out and struggling. Like, I'm thinking of even the game they played in 2019, Joe Smith Last Six Nations, where they won with a bonus point. But they were trailing at half-time, and there was a lot of poor, sloppy errors. And we came out with the result, but everyone was like, Jesus, like, there's alarm bells going here. I feel like if that's the case today, it's going to be very tough over the next couple of weeks. I think they just need to maybe a similar result performance to what they achieved in the autumn, where they played some really good rugby. Hugo Keenan scored some nice tries. Oh, man, he had that great offload, and they won well. Interesting point that I've heard a couple of people raise now is how, obviously, the attack is getting so much focus, but the defence has been very poor as well. Like, they've been caught out in wide channels a number of times between now and last autumn, and Italy's attack actually has been pretty lively. So, well, Ireland will probably win and win pretty comfortably. If they concede two or three sloppy tries as well, like that would be a real sore point, considering Farrell is meant to be the defensive guru, the defensive genius. Mm. It's both sides of the ball that will actually be under the microscope today, and I actually think they'll be under a bit of pressure to get them both right. I expect them to do it, but if things go wrong early doors, you know, from that 2013 game, weird things can happen, and the confidence probably isn't that high, so... it'll be interesting.
I agree with you. I couldn't agree with you more in terms of the defence. It's been very, very poor so far. Far too easy for teams to open us up. And it's been, you know, it has been under scrutiny. And I think that will need to stand up today, no question, against the Italians, because other teams, better teams, will destroy us and have done in that sense.
Just to come in for one second on that, like, just on the Italian attack, it's funny, like, they're, you know, they're getting all the praise now, and, you know, for their lively attack. And we're just thinking, my cat built that attack over 4 years, like, and now they're getting praised, and now he's with us, and like our attack can't do anything. It's like, where's this Italian? You know, but you built with Italy. It's just a funny kind of ironic little turn of events.
It is. Now, funnily enough, I was kind of, you know, being a bit tongue in cheek there, talking about at the very beginning when I just started chatting to you about, you know, welcome to Leinster to the four boys in question. But that being said, you know, that Leinster backline and the in the Pro 14, they have zero opposition and they carve their way through oppositions at will and get scores. And you could argue that the Italians are sort of in that vein. You know, there's a lot of that sort of level of player there. It would be interesting to see if it's a more Leinster-esque type style of attack that we see from that backline today.
Yeah, no, I saw a few people make that point as well. And, well, yeah, I agree with that point in the sense that, like, Italy are as close as you're going to get to a Pro 14 run out in international rugby. So I would expect, them to look good. And Lammer, make opportunities and Ringrose to make opportunities. All that'll tell me is personally that the team isn't completely gone yet. Like, they haven't gone through the floor in terms of confidence. It will be the Scotland and the England games that'll tell us. Like, I do expect them to look good today. They picked an exciting attacking team with good ball carriers. Ultimately, I think this is about, you know, like, just getting through and looking good doing it. Because even Wales last year in their terrible year under PVAC, they hammered Italy. Like, so that's kind of the bare minimum today. And then it's Scotland and England is where we'll really ultimately judge the team. All that can happen today is negatives, in my opinion. I don't really see, even if I look unbelievable and don't concede the point and score 50, people will still be rightly, I think, kind of waiting, holding pause until the Scotland and England games to see really where this team is at.
Okay. Well, it'll be an interesting one to watch. No question about it. We'll keep a close eye on it. Now, the other one that I can't wait to see later on today, of course, is the Wales-England game. Wales, you mentioned Pivac and his poor season last year and everything else. But, you know, it's gas. They're such an enigma, the Welsh. They really are. At club level, they're falling to pieces. They can't win a game. And here they are on track for a Grand Slam with arguably an English team that are not hitting the form that we would come to expect from them. Eddie Jones is under some pressure. There's a lot of people saying that he's not picking the form players that he should be. Certainly in the English media, there seems to be a lot of that talk going on. And here we are with Wales with a chance to push on even further for the Grand Slam. It's an intriguing but and fascinating game, this one.
Oh, massively. So you touched on a few things there that I think are interesting. Firstly, Eddie Jones and the issue of selecting players on form. Like, Billy Vunipola came out himself during the week and admitted he has been playing very poorly. Obviously, the Saracen situation is extremely unique. Their season hasn't got up and running, so they haven't really played any games by their England minutes. And then you have Sam Simmons playing for Exeter. I watched the game against Sale Sharks last night. They had 14 men for an hour. He was absolutely unbelievable leading them on. He's European Player of the Year. They won the double last year. He can't get into the England team. He can't even get into the squad. Yeah. And you have Billy Vunipola, who, you know, people maybe, you know, he doesn't look match fit. I don't think you're going out on a limb or you know, really critical saying that. And you can't even get into the squad. Like, Eddie Jones, to be fair, has a great success with England, and they have a huge playing pool, so there's obviously always going to be big names left out. But he does have a kind of an odd way of selecting, and he certainly has never really warmed to Exeter players generally or their style of play, given how successful they've been and how few of them tend to get into the squad. In terms of Wales, I think it's a really good opportunity for them today. I really do. Like, they really fluked the Scotland game, I think, you know, with that red card. But now they've gotten some key men back fit. Josh Adams has returned from that suspension he had for breaking the bubble. Like, yeah, you have a back three of Liam Williams, Lewis Rees-Samet, and Josh Adams. You have Davies and North in the centre, two really experienced guys. North looked pretty good, I thought, at 13 against Ireland. You know, you have a bigger with the experience. And then, like, you have your back row, Faletau, you know, Josh Navidi in there as well. Justin Tipperidge, who is playing out of his skin at the moment. Yeah. I think it's a great opportunity for them. And then, Jesus, if they're 3 from 3 with Italy to come in round 4, and you don't know what state the French could be with COVID in round 5, geez, no one. It would be one of the
if they get a result today, I absolutely wouldn't back against them going all the way, because they'd be, you know, it's the French game it'll come down to. I'm not so sure about the back row, though. I mean, Navidi, he's been out for a long time with injury, and he's only just kind of coming back. And then I think, what has he got? About up until when he came on last week, I think he'd only about 20 minutes since August.
Same as Vunipola then, like, you know. The same as Vinopola then.
Yeah, well, I know that's true, but we've just said Vinopola's form has been bad. Faletau, to be fair, I haven't seen what I'd like to see out of Faletau. He's a class player too, but he's been sort of quiet, I felt, so far.
Yeah, like, he's not the player he would have been, you know, 2017 Lions, back even 2013. He's, what, I think he's 31 now, 30 maybe. But he's been around the block since the 2011 World Cup. He isn't the same. And that was some of the criticism, the team selection of round one, where you're thinking Pivac is going to battle with the guys who, this would have been an exciting and a good team in 2013. Like, you know, they got 2 red cards in their first 2 games to win those games. So, realistically, if England stay to 15, it'll be a huge test for them.
Yeah.
I just think the way things are broken for them, some of the negativity from the first week has gone now with the 2 victories. Mm-hmm. And you can't underestimate, you know, the momentum that'll give them, and the key men coming back, as I mentioned, and the form of some of the guys that have shown recently. Like, England are favourites, and
They probably will squeak it, but I have a funny feeling that it could be Wales' day.
And what about the big conundrum at 10 for England? They're looking at Ford back in there again. I like George Ford, but I just don't... He's never really set the world on fire for me, for some reason, you know, for England.
Yeah, like, again, with the selection thing we were discussing, like, you have a situation where, like, Owen Farrell, obviously, they're Johnny Sexton in the sense that not only is he an unbelievable player, he's a huge personality, a huge figure in the game, he's a huge success. George Ford has been there for a long time. But then you have Joe Simmons, Sam Simmons' brother, ironically, at Exeter. He led them to the double. He's been unbelievable for Exeter for a number of years. He hasn't even been capped yet. Marcus Smith for Harlequins, a team who, you know, I think won four or five games in a row since their coach has left. He was the guy who was being tipped as Eddie from by Eddie Jones himself, and he's been in squads as like the next big thing. He's playing great rugby too. Similar maybe to our own situation, when you have such a big personality who's delivered free in the past, maybe it can be difficult to move them on. But I suppose, as you mentioned, George Ford seems to be constantly the number two, whereas surely I would have thought Joe Simmons, you know, winning a Champions Cup, winning a Premiership, playing out of his skin. Himself and his brother must be looking at each other around the family dinner table thinking, geez, what we did at each home. Like, you know, Farrell and Dunapola have barely played a minute and they can't be moved. We're playing unbelievable rugby, Europe and in England, and we can't even get into squad. It's a funny one. And if they lose today, if England lose today, they will be under massive pressure. With France to come and then a trip to Dublin, you wouldn't know how things could unfold. Like, because, you know, there was a bit of humming and hawing after the World Cup about whether Jones would stay on all the way, and I know he has a contract there, but you know what it's like in England. Things can turn very quickly.
I was just going to put that to you because, you know, I think people are underestimating just how big today is, because exactly what you said there, there's still tough games to come in this. We haven't seen England looking like world beaters by any means. And this is a game today. There's a huge banana skin for them, for the English today. But it seemed to me that a lot of the talk was that he's somehow bulletproof, Eddie Jones, that, you know, I saw Brian Moore talking about it and a few others. They're kind of saying they won't make a change like that this close to the next World Cup. It just will not happen.
Yeah, well, I suppose the funny thing is, like, he was more likely to go with the last World Cup because that was a year out. That was 2018 versus 2019. You're 2 years out. It'd be a bad Six Nations campaign, but the last run of form they had, they then went to South Africa and lost a test series. Then they were going into November under a lot of pressure. I suppose the interesting thing this time is there's a huge negativity, like, it came out after the Scotland game with the style of play as well. It's the way, like, if England are going to play that way, kind of like Ireland under Joe Schmidt, like, when you're really successful playing that kind of style of rugby, you know, no one can really complain. But if you're not winning, you know, people are justifiably like, well, is this the way we want to watch our national team play? Would we not want to see a more expansive style? And Eddie Jones has stuck to his guns. He's picked pretty much the same team. He hasn't really, like, he brought in Ollie Lawrence. A funny one. I brought in Ollie Lawrence, who got two touches of the ball against Scotland and then dropped him out of the 23. Like, pick one of the most exciting outside backs in the Premiership, and then you don't use him, and then you basically boot him out of the squad, probably destroying the guy's confidence. And you know how Eddie Jones is, he probably had a one-liner his on the way out the door for him. Yeah. I was like, is that the best way to run your ship? Like, he's kept great with the World Cup squad, that style of play, but yeah, I agree with you. That's why I'm really excited for today's game.
Yeah.
So there's so much on the line, and you wouldn't know what could happen afterwards.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that one. Just a quick mention of the Pro 14 before I let you go. Business as usual for the Irish provinces, Munster, Connacht. I was working on that one last night. They managed to drag it a victory. They weren't good. They didn't play anywhere near the standard that they can play. But they got a result, and that's all that matters. And Ulster, of course, getting their result as well. The Pro 14, it's just, I think, was it Rory that tweeted last night something along the lines, Rory O'Connor? I think he might have tweeted about another Pro 14 weekend, another dose of victories for Irish teams. Nothing to see here. It's kind of becoming, you know, monotonous, isn't it?
Yeah, to say the least. Like, I was targeting last night, this, you know, between the Sale-Exeter game, Sale-Exeter, and between Munster-Cardiff, because I really wanted to see what Carberry was doing. And I was thinking, like, Munster are like one of the best teams in Europe, and this is a pretty strong Munster team, but the spectacle was it just wasn't a good spectacle. It was just like watching it, teams cough and wheeze against each other, flick over to the Premiership, and you just see this unreal brand of rugby, like, you know, the offloading, the skill level is so high, Like, and it pains me to say it, because like Craig Doyle and the lads on BT can be so like insufferably smug about the Premiership, but like at the moment it is head and shoulders as a spectacle for me above the Pro 14. One thing that I think is interesting, like obviously the Rainbow Cup seems very pie in the sky because of South Africa and COVID and whatnot, but there does seem to be talk that potentially South African teams could come up to the Northern Hemisphere and just base themselves here for the duration, you know, do their quarantining so there's no, you know, hope of, you know, there'll be no, you know, importing variants or what have you, and maybe it could be run on that basis, which I really hope it does, because that could add that bit of oomph for missing if, say, Leinster locked and loaded in April at the RDS. You know, hopefully you wouldn't know, but they might be talking maybe crowds by the summer. And then you have like Sia Khaleesi and a Springbok-laden South African team coming into town. That could, like, I know we've kind of talked about it as a bit of a joke at this stage because it didn't look likely to happen. But yeah, if there is a way to get that played, it could really reinvigorate the tournament heading into next season, where you could potentially have a full league. The COVID picture is a bit better. And it could be a game changer. Like I'm probably being a glass half full person looking at it at the moment. But
Well, I mean, I don't think that's a bad thing to be a glass half full person. But my own feeling on it is that, you know, you're dead right. That competition just needs an injection of excitement. That's the bottom.
And even bringing them up, to be honest, like the good thing about the Premiership is like all the rivalries are inbuilt. Like it's like a league where you have teams from Ireland, teams from South Africa, teams from Wales, teams from Scotland, teams from Italy. Like, even if there is extra Springboks in the league, it's never going to be the same. Like, there's no great rivalries, but the Irish provinces playing themselves, you know. Yeah. It's just never going to be that. Like, so you're just trying to maximise what you have, which is all they can really do at the moment. Like, so you can't fault them for that, but they're in a tough place at the moment, and if the Rainbow Cup can't go ahead, all the tougher.
Absolutely. Okay, well, look, there's brilliant having a chat with you, as always. Enjoy the rugby for the weekend, and hopefully we'll be able to talk about happier times where Ireland are playing rugby that we're all very, very happy with.
Hopefully. Thanks, Reggie.
Take care, Will. That's Will Slattery of the Irish Independent, and also the Left Wing podcast as well that he does with Luke Fitzgerald. Well, after an 11-year journey, Dublin hurler Paul Ryan has called time on his inter-county career. The Ballyboden centre forward bows out with one Leinster title from 2013, a National Hurling League crown from 2011, the first in 72 years, and two Walsh Cup honours. And I'm delighted to be joined by him on the phone now. Good morning, Paul. How are you?
Reg, how you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks. Doing great. So tell me, how do you feel? How does it feel to be retired?
Sluggish.
Yeah, I know, yeah. I remember that feeling well. You wake up one morning, you're kind of like, oh, this will be great. And then you're going, geez, what am I going to do with myself now?
But, It might have been a bad idea in hindsight as I have a newborn. So, should have probably kept it up so I could get out of the house.
Lost all the excuses to get out of the house now. There's a bachelor.
I mean
you've had an amazing career, and unfortunately it comes to the best of us. The body just says I kind of can't take too much more of this, and you got to step down. So what made the decision for you?
I came back this year, and I suppose it all kind of happened over the last, say, 18 months. I was going quite well in Matty's first year, had started really well in Championship and was going great. And then right before the Galway game in Parnell, the Championship game, I blew my hammer out the back of the leg with a grade 2 hamstring tear, literally on the Thursday night before the game. So yeah, that was devastating. And then I was a good few months trying to get back to that. It just ruined my year. So then coming into, I suppose, 2020, I had a great pre-season, probably fittest I'd ever been. And I think it was January, Welsh Cup game. We had trained quite heavy down that week. But, went into that game, first 15 minutes, hamstring again. So I spent basically about 6 months there trying to get right. From that and one or two other things, and the grind started at me that hadn't been at me since I was 14 years of age. So it turned out that was Gilmore's groin, which is basically a tear in your groin. And I was injecting that with cortisone for, God, nearly 5 months, 6 months. And then the whole
COVID curtailed us, and then I was thinking, will I get surgery and I'll be back in time? But we decided not to get surgery and power on through it. But like everything started kind of, all you're doing there is you're passing the pain onto another part of the body. So anyways, yeah, I just really kind of came to a stage where I felt with all the injuries building up, I couldn't perform at that level last year, and then COVID hit again, and I just said, oh, look, this is this is going to keep going, and then it's going to carry on for another 8 months, and look, at the moment, I feel awful sorry for the lads. They're training away by themselves, and it's very, very difficult, and look, I just didn't want that, I just had the time, so,
That's fair enough when you come to the decision, and it's a tough decision, there's no question about it. Luckily, I never worry about hamstrings, I didn't have enough pace to worry about that. it doesn't matter what it is. It is a tough decision when you come to it. But like, when you look back in your career, and I know I do, you know, there are great memories. What stands out for you most, I suppose?
So the obvious is the league and the Leinster wins. Never in our wildest dreams, when I was coming into the Dublin panel initially when I was 18, 19, like Dublin hurling was nothing back then. There was great guys around the place. There was a few decent players, but still a very, very much a lack of belief in anything that we could do. And then, so the great Andy Daly came in then, and he changed all that and brought in guys, like some of the guys that he exposed us to were phenomenal. Like one of them was Gary Keegan, who was involved in the box, and he was one of the best we met. But just the way they talk, the way they frame everything, it's really just completely recalibrating the brain to think about success, and that you can actually reach heights that you never thought you could before.
Well, I mean, you know, obviously there's been big performances as well. I mean, you're getting man of the match when you beat Galway to lift the O'Keefe Cup for the first time in 52 years. So there are some memories there.
Like absolutely, like the Leinster win was definitely phenomenal. But I have to say, the league win, like it was just so unexpected from us that year. Like, would you believe, like that, when I came into that, that was one of my best years, 2011. But of course, everyone remembers the Leinster final, because it was pasted across the media, and it was, look, our first provincial title, but in a long time. But the league win now really felt like, I hate to say it, like it sounds crazy, but it felt like an All-Ireland at the time, because we had never had any success at that level, to that point. And it was like Dublin fans crying in the crowd and everything. There was we used to only have a few hundreds, if a thousand or two at a game. So like, it just meant so much to everybody back then. And yeah, it was just phenomenal how we, in 2009, 10, 11, we kind of just turned the cogs a different way and started believing that we belong here, we could do something here.
And Paul, I want to ask you about that, because it reminds me a bit of the early days with Leinster for me. So, you know, we were the same. We'd maybe had 500-600 people at games, and we started to get a few results. And then I'll never forget in 2001 when we beat Munster, there was 40,000 people in Lansdowne, and the tide changed. Now, what I'm interested in is that it really felt like Dublin hurling was going to push on from that point,
you
know, especially given the population that we have and the number of clubs that there are and the success of the likes of, you know, teams like Coola, who were kind of on the outskirts maybe back in the early days, and then they've pushed on to become this amazing club. But it doesn't seem to have progressed the way people thought it might at inter-county level.
Yeah, it's hard to put your finger on it. Like, we were so close under Dalo, especially 2013. We really should have drove on there. And look, everybody kind of looks at Ryan Dwyer standing off as default. And I know Ryan probably looks at that himself, but it wasn't. It was a multitude of things during that game. I missed a few frees. Like, little does Ryan know, I probably blame myself for a few years over. But, and then who else knows that there's other guys in the team that blame themselves, you know? But yeah, it is very disappointing, kind of the last few years. When Pat Gilroy took over, he really rocked the foundations again. And and guys were starting to say, Jesus, right, we could do something here. But unfortunately, Pat had to pass it on because of work commitments, which was very unfortunate because it had that feeling. But then again, like with Matty's first year, it was just silly that we went down to Laois and performed the way we did and let that happen. It shouldn't have happened after beating Galway.
Yeah.
The feeling in the camp was really, really good. But look, that's sport, isn't it? And yeah, last year wasn't good at all. So it's very hard to put your finger on it because within that group is good. Like,
yeah, no, absolutely. There's no doubt the commitment within the group is incredible. I'm just always intrigued about, in particular, Ireland as a country with regard to GAA. So you've got you've got Kilkenny and Tip and Limerick, then and they're the hurling counties, and then you've got Dublin and Kerry and up north are more into the football counties, and it seems to be that you're either a football or a hurling county, and very few can do both. Galway can do both to an extent, but maybe in football they haven't had the success that they would have liked, but they're always thereabouts. Do you know what I mean? But you don't hear of a great Mayo hurling team, for example. Why is Dublin kind of has fallen into that, but I don't really understand why that is when it's such a big population in Dublin that there should be. Is there enough effort being put into growing it?
I definitely do think there is now. Yeah. Like, I don't think it's anything to do with that, really. There's a lot of work going on across the clubs in Dublin, and there has been for a long, long time. It just seems to be lacking a small bit when it comes to belief at the senior level, but then again, like, you take the first year with Matty and it's just a flip of a coin. We went down and had a terrible performance against Laois, and then all of a sudden a group that was absolutely flying it is lacking a small bit, then thinking, oh Jesus, maybe we're not good enough, and it's just kind of ridding yourself of that and trying to just get back at it, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, no, I do always find it intriguing, though. I completely understand it with the likes of Kilkenny and Tip, and like I said, football in Kerry and different counties and Waterford for hurling and all that kind of stuff. I get that, but it just intrigues me with Dublin how they're not bringing it both, especially when there's so much talk around dividing Dublin up in the football and there's too much resources and they blah 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 blah. I'm just saying to myself, well, if they did the same with the hurling, would they not then dominate in the hurling? And it kind of seems to
exactly like I can tell you we won for nothing, so I don't believe that no matter kind of and pumping as much money as you want into it, like, but if you don't have the talent, you're not going to win.
Well, that makes it interesting to counter the argument of the football then for those that say it's all about the money. At the end of the day, you're right, it's not, it's about the talent as well.
And there's guys that have went into the football that are phenomenal hurlers, like Conor Collins, a great hurler, Costlow, Kieran Kilkenny was a very good hurler underage. Like, the major guys gone in there to the football.
That glamorous? Does it get more glamour? Because for me, hurling's a better game.
I'd have to agree. But I think what's gone on with football is just once in a lifetime stuff. If you're coming into that as a young guy, and you're looking at the hurling, can you blame them?
I don't understand that. You can't
blame them. Like, and the draw, I always loved as an intercounty guy, would never have had the crowds that the footballers had. But even when, on a big day of the league final that time, or the Leinster final, when we had maybe 50,000 or 60,000, like that was just it's like a drug. It's very hard to absolutely, and it's very hard to explain to guys. Like, my old mates now would saying, why would you bother? You're training 5-6 nights a week, you're giving up so much. And it's just like, lads, you've never played in front of once you've played in front of a few thousand, you're just chasing that the whole time.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't even ask that question if you knew it was, that's the reality. Well,
that's it, so there you go, that's the knowledge of my own mates.
Paul, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure. You've got to soldier on for Ballyboden, though. You're not completely
absolutely, we're not doing this.
No, that's good. That's good to hear, because we want to see plenty more scoring from you. Okay, Paul, absolute pleasure chatting to you. Really enjoyed that, and good luck with everything in the future, and enjoy the slightly slower pace maybe at Ballyboden, but I'd say there's few that say that it's not that much slower.
That's it. Thanks. Thanks, Reggie.
You're very welcome. Take care, Paul. All the best. Paul Ryan there, Dublin hurler, of course, finishing up his inter-county career and announcing that. So great chat with him. Really enjoyed that. Time to turn our attention to football, and I'm joined by the one and only Alan Cawley as usual. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, Reggie. I'm good. Thanks. Yourself?
Oh, very well. Thanks. Very well. Enjoyed the football during the week. There was plenty going on. I suppose Arsenal managing to get there in the end, to get that win against Benfica, which was a good result, I thought, was a bit of a joy to me, the 3-2 victory there. But I suppose the other one that was a big one was the Chelsea win over Atletico.
Chelsea was a massive win, Reggie. And obviously Tuchel, since he's come in, he's had a huge impact in the league. Now, people will argue some of the teams that they've played, he's had a nice run of fixtures, but you still have to put your imprint on the side when you come in as a new manager, and that's exactly what he's done. And they've gotten the victories, and he's gotten himself back into a position where it looks like they could get into the top four again. And when Lampard left, I suppose that was the reason he had left, because they were fearing that they wouldn't get into the top four. So since he's come in, he's made a real impact. And then to go to Atletico Madrid in the Champions League, which looked a really tough tie on paper. We all know what Atletico are like, particularly physically. They can be a tough team to play against, but I think the La Liga is on the wane a little bit. You look at Barcelona as well, getting hammered by PSG. Real Madrid are not the force of old. Sociedad getting hammered by Man United as well. So, albeit it was a brilliant victory to obviously beat Atletico Madrid, I still think La Liga is not as strong as what it was. But
what's
in terms
going
of two,
on there, actually, it's an interesting point. I mean, you know, it's like Spanish football is such, you know, high status, number one game in the country. How could it be drifting so badly?
Yeah, they've been so good over a number of years, Reggie. And like, you look at the Spanish teams, and I think the stats go back to 2010-11, since the last time a Spanish team was in the semi-final or the final and stuff. So Real Madrid obviously winning it 3-4 years as well. Barcelona doing so well. But I think they've been hit massively by the pandemic and stuff. And the financial side of things are not good over there at all. Like Barcelona and Real Madrid, particularly Barcelona, are on the brink of, they're talking about bankruptcy. Messi's contract that was leaked the other day, and I think they've been hit so bad by the pandemic as well, and obviously there's been bad management as well, and there's chaos going on off the pitch, not only on the pitch as well. So it is interesting to view from the outside. I suppose we don't get to see as many of the league games as what we used to, because of the Sky contract being gone now. We used to watch the games at the weekend, and they used to have great coverage, but I do know that it's not as strong as what it was, and that's obviously evident in the results of the European matches as well.
Yeah, it's hard to believe, because I went over there last year with the kids to a Real Madrid game and did the stadium tour and everything else, and the history and the size and everything. I was walking around with my mouth open just at the size of this place and the history, like the museum that you go through on the tour. It's mind-blowing. So it's impossible for me to imagine that something like a machine of that size right in the middle of a city of that nature could be faltering. And Barcelona the same. Quite incredible.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, as you said, the history behind the clubs, and they're so big, like they're monumental, really. Now, the Bernabeu was undergoing, obviously, reconstruction at the moment. So it will come back, Reggie, I think. Yeah. But they might go through a few kind of barren years to get them back to where they once were. But certainly with Barcelona, there's major, major trouble financially, because a lot of their loans, I know a lot of teams and clubs, big clubs all over the world, United and all the different teams, are massively in debt. But I think the main problem with Barcelona is a lot of them are short-term loans, whereas all the other clubs have big investors behind them, or their long-term loans. So that's the problem with the moment, Barca.
Very good. Okay, let's get back to the Premier League, closer to home, and everybody's interested in it. And the one I'm interested in, we spoke last week about West Ham and how they had the opportunity to get up into fourth, and they've done just that, sitting there in fourth. But a big one against City. But like, it's a tricky one all the same for City to get over. They can't afford to slip up at this stage.
No, definitely not. But City are in unbelievable form. You mentioned, obviously, we touched on the European games there, but in their European game, they won comfortably against Mönchengladbach, so that's taken the record now to 19. It will be a tough game. I agree, West Ham are in brilliant form. David Moyes has done an unbelievable job. Whether he can get finish top four, I'm not so sure, but even if they were to finish in the top six, Reggie, I think it would be an unbelievable return for them, and he'd be over the moon with that. And this is a bit of a free hit for them, really. Nobody expects them to get a result, so they can go to the Etihad in full of confidence and have a right crack at Man City, and that's what I'm expecting them to do as well. They have a very good side. As I say, they're banging confidence. And I genuinely feel if Moyes was to finish fourth, Reggie, I think that would be an as good achievement as Man City winning the league.
Yeah, I agree.
It would be incredible if they finished fourth. It really would.
Absolutely, I agree completely. The other team, and they're, the one I mention every time, is Leeds, of course, and they're having a fantastic season, in my opinion. You know, sitting middle of the table, nice and comfortable. Leeds fans have to be feeling good about themselves, and they've got Villa, and again they're at home to Villa, and if they can get a victory over them, they could push themselves up even further up into 8th place. So I mean, you know, it's a cracking season for them.
It is. They've been absolutely brilliant, and Bielsa obviously got all the hype before the season started, and he's lived up to all that hype because he has been a breath of fresh air, and his team have been a breath of fresh air. They're great to watch. It's win or bust, basically. You look at I think they've played 25 games. They've won 11, they've lost 12, and they've only had 2 draws. So, as I say, it's all out attack and win, or else they lose 2 or 3 nil. And it makes for great viewing as well, because it's kamikaze stuff at times with them. They're playing Villa, obviously, who are having a decent season themselves. But I think this will be a really good game, because both of them go out and attack and go out and play. It's a pity Jack Grealish, it doesn't look like he'll be fit. He'll be a loss for Villa. But as you say, the incentive for Leeds to get up into 8th place, and the only thing that's missing from Leeds season is the fact that I know from personally speaking, Elland Road would be absolutely bouncing, Reggie. And it's just a pity that the fans are obviously not in witnessing and seeing this at the moment. But hopefully, if they have a good season and finish it off properly, Bielsa will be there again next year and the fans will be back.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. It would be hopping. That is the pity that they'll miss out on that one. But they will be next year, because they're definitely going to still be there. What was I going to say to you? Yeah, Man United. I spoke to Ken earlier on. Good old chat with him about things, but he's happy enough with the way things are going at United, but they have a big one now against Chelsea tomorrow.
I'm surprised he was able to talk through. He's running snooker now and everything,
yeah,
Reggie.
But I did say to him, Alan, you know, it's a real sign you're getting old when you're being put on board. So
that's a true sign, yeah. He's the next Barry Hearn, I'd say, in waiting.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, it is a difficult tie for United, but it should be a good game as well. We obviously spoke about Chelsea and the impact Tuchel has had. But United had a good win in Europe as well. He rested a couple of players. So, that should be a good game tomorrow. I'm looking forward to it. United just have to stabilise that position and finish second, I think, in the league. I don't think they're going to win it. It's 10 points now of a gap. Nobody can stop Man City, I don't think. Yeah. But once they stabilise that position, finish in second, it will look good for Solskjaer. People will be saying it's progress. Sunshine, 106.8.